How did you start working for the Treasury, and where did you come from?
Okay, I was teaching at the University of Chicago. I was an assistant professor there, and I was teaching the course called Money, this first-year graduate course. And then I was working with Milton Friedman in the Money Banking Workshop, and we have been doing quite a bit of research together. And when I was hired there, they said I was pretty much told that, at least for the foreseeable future, that they didn't really envisage that I was going to get any tenure there. So I had been in Chicago for just too many years anyway, and so I wasn't actively looking for anything, but I was sort of amenable to moving on. And my old friend Alan Meltzer had been in the Treasury for a short time. Alan, he took leave from Carnegie. They hired him, and he was only there for about a week, but he quit because he was told that he would be involved in policy making at the highest level. And when he found out that he wasn't, he essentially said, "I'm wasting my time here. I'm going home." So he went home, but he used to come back and forth. So they told him that they were setting up a new office, and that they were looking for some very good economists. And it was really through Alan's marketing that I made contact with them.
So what was the date that you went to the Treasury?
I went to the Treasury in the fall of 1962, and what happened was that they set up a new office called the Office of Financial Analysis. The director of the office was Paul Volcker. Paul Volcker came from the Chase Bank. And before that, he had been at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Right.
And before he came, the director was Frank Morris, who later went on to become the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston for many years.
Right. I've interviewed him.
Yeah. And everything really reported up to Bob Rosa, who was undersecretary of the Treasury for Monetary Affairs, everybody, this new office reported to him. And in the office, they got the reason that, as I understood it, that they set up the office was that the Council of Economic Advisors was, and this was early in the Kennedy administration, was really a powerhouse. And when the Treasury people went over to have meetings with the people from the council, this is particularly the secretary, who was Douglas Dillon, he thought that he was outgunned. So he wanted his own troops. And so he brought together, so they set this up, and they got special authorization to hire super grades and do various other things. And the people who came in with me included Jack Kerrigan from the University of Minnesota.
Right, I talked to him too.
Yeah. Sam Chase, who came from the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. Carl Madden, who has since passed away. Carl had worked with Paul Volcker at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and although he had a PhD in economics from the University of Virginia, he was more of a publicist, and so he was a good speechwriter, and is not a bad economist, but not the same analytical caliber as the other people. and studied some productivity, and he'd worked on this something called the Corporate Sources and Uses of Funds, which I had done, also worked on at the National Bureau of Economic Research, as part of the flow of funds. And so we had this a group of people there, and under Paul Volcker.
Dewey Dane and Peter Sternlight, they were there also?
Dewey Dane was there. I'm not sure that Peter Sternlight was there. And Dewey Dane...
Well, Sternlight would have been more in the marketing, treasury security function.
He may have been there. I don't recall him. I met him at other times.
He was there. I've talked to him, too.
He was there? Okay.
Yes.
Once the decision was made to open to start this new office, and then it took a while, took quite a while to hire the people, and then there were academics. It took them a long time to get there, and the whole thing really didn't come together until September, and once we were there, it was clear that they didn't know what the hell to do with us. And Volcker would hand out little assignments, the person who had the most responsibility, was most involved, was Sam Chase, who had come earlier, and Sam was working on. Various problems of banking structure and regulation.
Right, he did some stuff with Lyle Gramley.
Later on, right. And the two of them were alumni of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, where they met there, and they were, through the years, very close friends.
Sam Chase is still around, I assume?
He later... He was at the University of Montana. He's from Montana. He has a Berkeley PhD. Is an undergraduate at Dartmouth. A very bright guy, very tense man. I think he had four daughters or five daughters. If I had five daughters, I'd be tense. So, he came back from Montana. He was with the Fed, the Board of Governors, working on bank structure, financial market structure problems. Then he later went into a private consulting business with Carter Galembi, worked for Galembi Associates, and I think he was a partner there. Did that for some years, and then he went off on his own. And I think now he still does some consulting, primarily with the ABA, and is sort of partly retired. And he still lives in Chevy Chase.
Oh, so I could look in the phone book and...
I'll give you his number.
Oh, okay.
I see him from time to time, and we're good friends. And he would be very knowledgeable, and I'm sure he would be happy to talk to you. He lives in Chevy Chase. It's Samuel B. Chase Jr. Samuel Chase Jr.
Tell me about the personalities of the individual there. Did you ever meet Douglas Dillon? Talk to him?
I would see him at some big meetings, or sometimes I'd bump into him in the corridor or something like that. And I really can't say that I had much in the way of enough of an interaction with him really to make any kind of judgment. At that time, there was a group of treasury consultants, so-called, and the person in charge of it was Seymour Harris from Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have these meetings. In fact, I had been invited to some of those meetings when I was still in Chicago.
Oh, you two must have had some interesting conversations.
Well, there was a large group, but not really.
Okay.
He had an office in the Treasury and would spend a day or 2 weeks there, largely running this group of consultants.
Okay.
And what they would do is the consultants, there'd be a meeting on a specific topic or several topics, and people would come from all over the country, but primarily from Washington. And they'd have a group of academics and sometimes a bank economist or something like that. And some people would be assigned responsibility for making presentations or preparing a paper of some sort. And then there'd be a lot of discussion. During that time, there'd be various Treasury people who would be there. You'd get the top people from the Treasury, like Douglas Dillon would sometimes come, and he would spend a large part of the day there. Paul Volcker would be there, or the other people you just mentioned, Dewey Dane and the others. And mostly the Treasury people listened. Sometimes they'd raise the question, and Douglas Dillon would mostly listen, occasionally raise the question. And I don't recall that he ever contributed much, but he listened. And that was the point, was really to inform the Treasury officials. And that'd be some pretty free-swinging discussion. And I thought that was very helpful. I think one of the things that it did was it not only exposed them to different points of view, but it also told them what people were thinking. And they would then get a whole catalog of talking points, and which they could use in their own presentation. And so, even if they disagreed with somebody, it's something they had to take into account, or very often points were made which would show up in testimony or speeches or whatever. And Volcker was very good at that. We would meet, our group would meet with Bob Rosa from time to time. But I don't recall that we ever met with Dillon.
Do you have any sense of Rosa as an economist, or was it mostly?
Oh yeah, I had a yeah. I.
So how did he look at the world? He was a John Williams Keynesian, but with the emphasis on financial markets.
Financial markets, and he was trained at Michigan, University of Michigan. He was a Keynesian, is kind of a funny kind of Keynesian. He thought that financial markets were very complicated and very complex, and that there was a lot of sort of market segmentation. And he thought that...
So he was very much in the sprawl, New York...
He was very... That's right. In fact, he, during the 50s, he wrote extensively. I remember when I was in the mid-50s, I was at the National Bureau in New York, and I would sometimes visit down there. In fact, they once offered me a job. The only time the Fed has ever offered me a job or anything, but the... that's...
Yeah, that was before they knew.
Before my reputation was formed, but the... And that's where I first met Paul Volcker. I met him at lunch with a group of people there. And they were worshipful of Bob Rosa because of his very detailed, sophisticated, and almost superhuman insight and understanding of financial markets. And that he was the only one who knew all these connections.
But it's interesting what you say about the New York connection. I talked to Karakin not long ago, and he said the reason Rosa left the Fed and went to the Treasury was that Rosa gave a public defense of New York's position against the board's position, bills only, and that after that, Martin, saw to it that he couldn't rise any further.
Is that right? Yeah. Well, that was a big thing about bills only. That was a big controversy then. And I think that one of the reasons that some of the people in the Treasury were favorable to hiring me, even though I came from Chicago and was a student of and a colleague of Milton Friedman, was that my work on the term structure.
Okay, let me ask you about that. Unfortunately, I didn't start this project until after Rosa had died. So
Let me tell you a little bit about Bob Rosa, because he was a very important person in this.
Yeah.
And Bob Rosa was an intervener and a fiddler in financial markets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Sproul. And,
Bob Rosa, at the time, we were struggling with a $35 price for gold, and we were losing gold. And the Treasury was really beset by worries about the gold. And they were in a dilemma, because we were losing gold, and at the same time, there was a belief that we had that the country was in, if not a full recession, at least a semi-recession, and that particularly in 1962, mm-hmm. the stock market crack in the spring of 62, and there was the belief that we might be headed back into another recession.
That's right.
So they were sweating blood,
yeah.
because the usual things that they thought about to fight the recession would make the gold situation worse. And so that Rosa was struggling to find some financial weapons or some kind of finagling or to do something that could accommodate both. And they thought of different things. One of them was that really didn't come from them, but it came from the council, was this so-called Operation Twist, which they never did anything about anyway, which was to try to change the term structure of interest rates by pushing up short rates, which they thought would attract foreign capital, and pushing down long rates, which they thought could stimulate domestic investment and be expansionary. By changing the relative quantities of public debt.
Right, the outstanding maturity of the public debt. But I want to ask you about that, because having gone back to talk to people have very different
mm-hmm.
opinions on what Rosa had in mind. Some people say that Rosa didn't really believe in Operation Twist. It was done to accommodate Tobin in particular at the council,
mm-hmm.
with the idea that all the council really cared about was long-term interest rates. If they could persuade the council that they were doing something to keep long rates down, that would give the Fed more flexibility to raise short rates, so that this was more a way of putting off pressure from the Treasury than something that Rosa really truly believed would...
Well, I really have no knowledge of that. Mm-hmm. I just... the person who may know, Sam Chase may know more of that.
Okay.
See? Now, incidentally, and Sam and I have talked about this a lot, what I'm just going to say, which mm-hmm. is this, in terms of the role of that office, that between the time Dylan came to the conclusion that he needed more support, and he needed people to do battle with the council. It turned out that assigned to the Treasury. And Dillon and the county, and whenever there was, typically when there was a conflict, the Treasury would win and the council would lose. So once having brought this group together, then the people who were really running the show, including Rosa, they didn't feel that they really needed us anymore, because they could win without us. Because Treasury did not have to play the council's game. In fact, one person you may be interested in talking to is a man by the name of Marshall Kaplan. You know about Marshall Kaplan?
No, the name's not familiar.
Okay. Marshall Kaplan is a Chicago PhD. When I came to town, he was working at the council. He started working at the council when Arthur Burns was there, and when Walter Heller came in, he just kept him on. He later went on to, he left the council after some time, and he was with the Federal Home Loan Bank, and then he was in consulting. And I saw him in Chicago in the fall when we had sort of had a reunion of people who were there 40 years ago in Chicago. And unfortunately, he's had a stroke, but it impairs his mobility, but his mind is perfectly fine.
Okay, so do you have a phone number on your Rolodex?
Let me see if I have one for him. He'd be a wonderful person to talk to, because I want to tell you a story about, because I had lunch, what he told me the first day I was there. No, I don't.
Okay, do you have an address?
I suspect that he probably lives in the Maryland suburbs. But if you cannot find it, let me know, and I will call people at the University of Chicago and get the address for you. Because he'd be very good to give you the council, what was going on in the council.
So I could call the alumni office? And
maybe, yeah. Marshall Kaplan, he has a PhD. Maybe in the late 50s.
Okay, I can call the alumni office.
If not that, there's somebody I was going to call at the business school who had his address. Claire Friedland.
Oh. Yep. Okay, well.
Anyway, I remember I had lunch with Marshall, we were chatting about what was going on, and then he said that the general impression about Kennedy and what was going on in the administration was absolutely wrong. And he says, never forget that Kennedy is his father's son.
Yeah.
He says he's a financial Puritan. He loves gold and he hates deficits.
Yeah. That's written up a couple other places. Martin Mayer wrote a book about this period.
Is that right? Okay.
And
he said, and so given that, and he said he told me that the council really didn't have that much clout. So these guys were running around making speeches, giving seminars, etc. So Kennedy let him run around, you know, and get their jollies out of these presentations. But when it came down to it, the Treasury had the clout.
Yeah.
Or it typically did, see.
That's right. The other thing was that Kennedy had been elected on a program of sacrifice. And then after the Berlin Wall went up,
mm-hmm.
he didn't feel like he could then go around and say, let's relax discipline, let's, spend a lot of money, let's cut taxes. He felt constrained. If he was asking the public for sacrifice, then he felt like he couldn't then tell the public, well, the government is not going to share in this sense of sacrifice.
Well, you know, there were no big spending plans, the only, except for the military.
Yeah.
And even after Kennedy was shot, when Johnson filled out that term, there was no spending.
That's right.
And in fact, it was they perceived the problem as one, the stabilization problem from the Keynesian standpoint was one of fiscal drag. There was so much money coming into the Treasury.
That's right.
And that's when they started to think about, what are we going to do with the money? They said, well, we can't spend it. So what we'll do is we'll give grants to the states. Let them spend it.
That's right.
That's where it started. And the person who came up with that is Joe Peckman.
The Heller Council, and particularly Galbraith, who was sending letters from India at that time, they very much wanted a deficit through increased government spending.
That's right.
But Kennedy told Heller, if you want a tax cut, if you want a deficit, it's got to be through a tax cut and strict control of government expenditure, or Harry Byrd and the rest of the Democrats won't go along with it.
Yep, yep. And so the explosion did not start until Johnson and until the Great Society.
Yep.
Anyway, so there was great fear and trepidation about the gold, and they were in the Treasury. They were particularly concerned about foreigners coming to America and borrowing at our low interest rates, and that we had I think at the time we probably had a deficit on capital accounts, so we had a surplus on trade accounts.
That's right.
So they focused on the part of the equation where there was a deficit, and there'd be times when they had great concern that they had heard stories that a government or a municipality in Europe was negotiating with a Wall Street firm to borrow money. And a great upset. And so Bob Rosa, at some of our meetings, he would talk about some finagling here and there and whatever to try to impede that, or to try to do something to strengthen the exchange rate, which didn't have much wiggle room, but it had some, and to keep the U.S. from exporting capital.
So Rosa came up with, or at least worked out the details of the interest equalization tax. That was Treasury.
Well, I think that, the interest equalization tax came into being after I left. But I was given to understand that was put together by Paul Volcker, but I'm not sure.
He worked
out, I wasn't there at the time.
He worked out the details of it.
And so maybe the idea came from the general idea or concept came from Rosa, and Paul worked out the details.
Yeah.
That's perfectly consistent, because at that time, Paul was still more of a staff person, and he'd be implementing whatever the boss wanted. See, my feeling about him was that he was a loyal staff person, and he got his marching orders from his superior, and in best Prussian style, he was going to salute and do his best.
Sure.
And he couldn't understand why this group of characters that he'd assembled that didn't do the same for him. He wanted me to do for him what he was doing for Bob Rosa and for the for Douglas Dillon.
Yeah.
And so yeah. I came there as a truth seeker, after all my years at the University of Chicago. And so I was prepared to give my best shot to understanding a problem and implementing it, and giving it the best economic analysis, not to take my directive from a political decision made by whoever at the Treasury. And so there were. On various occasions, he would ask me to do something, and I would say, I can't do that. basically fell apart within a few months. Mm-hmm. Sam Chase quit, Carrigan quit, and the Volcker stopped asking us to do things. And so that long times would go by and we wouldn't see him. And we were just left alone in our offices. So I went off and I started writing some other papers. And I was looking for another job. I was the last of them to go, except for this Herman Liebling, who stayed on for a number of years. And the reason I was the last to go was it was a little harder for me to get a job. See? And so now Volcker worked closely with Liebling, and he found him very useful because Liebling knew all the damn numbers, everything. Mm-hmm. And he had contacts all through the government, so he could get sometimes the people who were preparing data would give him preliminary data. And he had a better sense about the reliability and the sources of the new statistics than other people because he'd worked on them. And so he developed a very close working relationship with Volcker, and he fed him a lot of stuff that later went out through the Treasury. And we didn't have that role, and so the whole thing dissolved. And so I came in September, I left in May, but I was the last of them. Hmm. And so even his old buddy, Carl Madden, left, and he went to, I think he worked for the Senate Banking Committee. I left, and for a time I worked for the House Banking Committee, and then in the fall, in September of 93, I started teaching at Hopkins. And then I was working for the Democrats. It was really Wright Patman. And there again, it was through Al Meltzer was the matchmaker.
Yeah. Before we get to that, let me ask you a few more questions about the Treasury. You came after the Treasury began the practice of swaps, and after the Exchange Stabilization Fund basically ran out of money.
Oh, the Exchange Stabilization Fund.
Yeah. Did you have any discussions about that? That's a particular interest.
I'm trying to think about it, and
it ran out of money basically because the funds had been used for the Alliance for Progress.
Is that right?
To lend to Argentina.
Oh, I don't read.
Okay, and then they needed money.
I don't remember that. I did remember that my paycheck was said Exchange Stabilization Fund on my paycheck.
Oh.
They paid me out of that. I knew it was the giant flush fund.
Yeah, I hate to think who else along with you got paid out of it over the years.
I know, but it, to
some,
me, it's
some
it
really
seemed it,
notorious company.
Just a joke about it, that it was a big flush fund.
That's what it is.
And that the Secretary of the Treasury had at his disposal.
And now it's a $20 billion flush fund.
But it's even bigger.
Yeah, okay, well.
The office really didn't accomplish a hell of a lot.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any discussions involving Bill Martin at the time? Anybody make comments on his relation with the Treasury or any?
I don't recall. Mm-hmm. No, I don't recall.
Yeah.
I had friends at the Fed. I'd go visit them. We were very friendly. And it's people that I had known from graduate school, say people like Steve Axelrod and whatever. But I, Martin just was just kind of a fixture there.
So you knew Axelrod?
Oh, I knew Axelrod when we were both graduate students, right?
So tell me, I've not talked to him yet. He's recently retired, and I will talk to him. But so he was a graduate student in economics?
Yeah. He has a bachelor's degree from Harvard. He came to Chicago. Mm-hmm. He never finished his degree.
Okay.
And he married a woman who was also a graduate student in economics, whose name was Catherine. I think her maiden name was Podolsky or something like that. And then he and I were also both at that time. There was in Chicago. There was a committee on planning, and in my crazy youth, I thought that that was the way to go. So I took a year long course of three quarters in a course called socioeconomic planning, and that convinced me to be a free market person. Because it was a wonderful course because I read all the planning literature. Then when I came at midway through it, I said, "Is that all there is to it?" You know, I read Lange's essay on the economic theory of socialism, and he made the strongest case. And I saw that if that's the strongest case, there's no case.
Did Axelrod have any ideas of his own that you can ever remember? I mean, he was always a...
As a student? No.
Yeah, as any...
He was kind of a... And... I don't think he ever felt he fit in there. So he left and he got a job at the board,
yeah,
in kind of the international section. And then the next thing I heard, he rose very quickly, and they used to joke about how he used to play tennis with Martin, and he had his tennis racket ready, at the ready, whatever Martin wanted to play. So that didn't hurt his advance. He was a loyal, effective. My impression is that he was a very loyal, effective person inside the Treasury, and he was sort of an intellectual adversary of mine.
Mm-hmm.
But he was always loyal to whatever was going on there.
Yeah.
And he was there for many years. And before he went out in the private sector, where he probably made a bundle of money.
Yeah, I'm sure he did.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about going to the Congress and the House Banking Committee and working for Patman. When did you do that?
I did that, I think it was May of 63. And what happened was that Patman had been waiting in the wings there for many, many years to become chairman.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a man who was chairman who was in his dotage. I think his name was Brent Spence from Kentucky. And he was well into his 80s, and he kept getting reelected, and Patman was the number two man. And then finally he took over as chairman, and then one of the first things he did was to start an investigation of the Federal Reserve, or
yeah,
start an inquiry.
Yeah.
And so he went out and he got in touch with Alan Meltzer. The reason was that when Patman was on the Joint Economic Committee, they commissioned Alan to do a study of the government bond market, or
right,
the dealers.
Right.
They liked the results, so he was one person, one economist. So they got Alan, and of course, then Alan, of course, got Carl Brunner, and then Alan told me that they were looking for people, so I went over there, and they hired me, and then they hired a whole bunch of other people, and that's how, through me, we got to hire Bob Weintraub, and then Don Jacobs, who later was dean of the business school at Northwestern, and a man by the name of Ira Scott. And it turns out that every single one of us had voted Republican in 1960, but Patman didn't care about that.
Sure.
What he cared about was the fact that we weren't in, none of us were in the Fed's pocket. And we started
Sure.
I was tangled up in things going on in the committee, and I was too close to it, so I really didn't produce anything that was publishable. Well, and then I started teaching at Hopkins, and then between the two, it was too hard. I was working part time, so sometime late in the fall, I quit.
So you quit in the fall of '63.
Fall or winter of '64. I just hung on for a few months more, and then by that time, Bob Weintraub, I think, was coming down. Although he didn't have a background in money, he was smart and a fast learner. He got a degree from Chicago, I think, in labor. And then there are other people. It was like a daisy chain. Other people came into the banking committee through the years. A man by the name of Dean Carson, who was a good friend, and some others.
Is there anybody around still from the mid-60s who was on the staff I could talk to about 65 and 66 especially, Reg Q and Patman's attack on the Fed? I'd really like to get some idea of, from the congressional perspective, whether they ever really thought they had a good chance to change the Federal Reserve Act to limit Fed independence, whether the Fed was really running scared.
I will tell you. See, Bob Weintraub and I were very dear friends and very close friends through the years. Yeah. We talked almost every day for a number of years. And we used to talk about Patman a lot. Mm. Because he was not the usual kind of politician. And there was a lot about him that was very enigmatic. Patman had a big reputation as being a Fed basher, a Fed hater, kind of a goofy guy, a dangerous man, whatever. And that didn't bother him a whit. In fact, I think he probably liked it. And the thing is that Patman had an almost perfect batting average whenever he brought legislation to the House floor, which is zero. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't get anything through the House. And through many years of discussion with Bob Weintraub, it was clear to us, and this is also through some hints that Patman gave to him, that Patman basically was not really interested in monetary policy. That the whole, he wasn't really interested in the Fed. That the whole thing was a diversion. He wanted a cause to divert attention from what his real interests were. And his real interests were really had to do with financial structure. And it had to do with getting special provisions that were helpful to the savings and loans, the building people, the whole real estate thing that went through the House.
So he was more interested in credit allocation.
He was interested in credit allocation,
monetary
and particularly.
Policy. I mean, what you associate him with is his attacks over high interest rates. So, but you think he
never, in fact. I mapped out, there were some things I remember working on for him where the Fed was tightening or seemed to be tightening, and I didn't think it was the right thing to do. So I mapped out, I still remember, I mapped out a whole plan of attacking every element in the Fed plan at that time, in whatever discussion they had or justification. And I thought that it was flawed at every single point. And he structured it so it was just kind of muted. So he didn't want to hit it. He wanted to make a fuss, but not enough really to make a damn bit of difference.
Okay, this is important to me because
it's really a different interpretation.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the Fed, on the one hand, talks about its independence. On the other hand, it likes to have this argument in pocket that, you know, whenever there's a problem, inflation gets out of hand. Well, it was political pressures. If you really push it,
yeah, but he didn't have any.
Yeah, we were really,
I understand that. We had to do it because otherwise they would have taken our independence away.
You know,
that's like the girl who would protect her virtue by always giving in.
It's important for me to get as many people talking about it as I can, because it's hard. If you push the Fed will say, well, you know, we really can't, there's no evidence of this, of course, of this, that we were just about to have our independence taken away. But the way it works is that the chairman gets subtle hints from the chairman in the Senate Banking Committee, and, you know, that he better back off, and...
I think most of that was empty. And, you know, Patman would make a, you know, he would appeal to his supporters and constituents and contributors, and so he would make a big thing about the expenses that some of the regional banks, and that they bought 400 ping-pong balls for a recreation room at the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. And he had people on the staff who did nothing. He would have some people who would just crank out this garbage.
Mm-hmm.
See? And so, and at the same time, he had some very good people involved there, you know, like Brunner and Meltzer and Bob Weintraub. And so it was this funny mixture. But in my recollection, I don't know of anything that Patman was ever any important legislative change that Patman was ever responsible for initiating and carrying through. He had a lot of initiatives, but nothing ever happened.
Nothing on the Fed directly.
Ever happened on the Fed. Nothing.
Were you at all aware of what was going on with Reg Q in 1966? Were you at all involved?
I was not involved. I left there, and then I was working at the, and I worked in South America for a while. Then I came back, and I was working at the Office of the Control of the Currency, and I had some involvement there about the flap about Reg Q, and I'm a little fuzzy about it right now.
Okay.
And there was, in 66, interest rates were rising,
yeah.
And it started to, some of the various interest ceilings were starting to get screwed up. And I think it was in the spring of 66, I went to work for the, on leave from the controls office, I went to work for the World Bank.
Let me come back to your general discussions with Bob Weintraub, and maybe we could talk a little bit about Arthur Burns.
Okay.
Did he ever have the feeling that Burns, what you've just told me was that if I want to explain what Martin did, why he behaved the way he did, it wasn't because he was forced into it by an angry Congress. It was either because he had...
From my recollection, I don't know that there was an angry Congress beating on him, and that in many respects it wasn't even an angry Patman. I think the whole thing was a charade.
Yeah, I've had other people who talked to people who testified before him, and Patman would ask a very pointed, angry sort of a question, and the person would come back with nothing, and then Patman would say nothing. You know, it was like the staff had written out the question, and he would read it off, and then there would be nothing, no follow-up.
It was all structured that way. Yeah. Patman was as friendly and as genial, as grandfatherly as you can imagine. And then they'd be all at the Fed, they'd talk about him as if he was a raving madman, and so would the press. You know,
of course, the Fed liked that image.
That was all part of the theater of it all.
Yeah.
See.
Yeah, that's.
And
good.
So they had to hold him up as a demon. weapon and as a threat. And that was easy for them to justify a lot of stuff.
Did, in your discussions with, I mean, I'd be interested in anything you can remember that Bob Weintraub told you, because one of my great, great regrets is that I didn't talk, I mean, he died so prematurely. It was just...
Oh, yeah. I still miss him. I miss him a lot. He died 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's hard for me to believe that so many years have gone by. We were very close, and we talked almost every day. And I saw him a lot. We were very close, and I was very, very fond of him, and I had the highest respect for him. And he was he had a lot of effect, and when he died, it left a hole on the hill that is never. There's nobody's replaced him.
That's right.
And the people who worked in the area are just they're different kind of people. It's just he was very effective. And he had a high sense of integrity. At the same time, he was working with politicians. And he primarily was working with Democrats.
Yeah.
And it was unusual.
He could work with...
And as far as I know, he was fit until he got a stroke that killed him. In fact, the week before, I went to see him. I was going to make a presentation on California, and I was struggling with a paper, and I went to see him to talk with him about some things. I was dragging my ass. I was so tired and bleary, and I went to see him in his office, and he was jumping up and down. The telephones were ringing, and I thought to myself, God, I wish I were as fit as he is. So you never know.
If I had asked him... why did you get the kind of monetary policy you got under Arthur Burns? What do you think he would have said under Nixon, say, 70, 71, 72?
Arthur Burns gave Nixon what Nixon wanted.
And why did Arthur Burns do that? What was his motivation? I mean, surely Arthur Burns was out for Arthur Burns, not...
Out for Arthur Burns, and he was so... he wanted to give Nixon whatever he wanted, and Nixon was he was so focused on winning that 72 election. There was nothing. There's hardly a single thing that there's hardly a single lever he didn't press.
Yeah, we know.
And so he would stop at nothing for that. Essentially stop at nothing for that. And Burns went along. Now, here's the guy. I mean, he went along with wage and price control and everything. He knew what was involved.
But because Burns believed that it was important for the country to have Nixon, or because he thought as long as Nixon was around, he, Burns, would be a key player?
I can't answer that. I wouldn't know.
Yeah.
I can't answer that. I suspect he had attached himself to Nixon, and who knows what tricks you play on yourself. But I do know that when Carter came in, that Burns was working very hard to be reappointed.
Sure.
And so that the first year he was in, when the Carter crew came in, they came in convinced that we were in a recession and with a possibility of going down even more. And they came in to fight a recession.
Yeah, Charlie Schultz came in as if it was 1962 all over again.
Yep.
It was strange, as if nothing had happened for the last...
And so that's right, and the guy, and whatever his name was at the Treasury, the whole thing.
Blumenthal,
right. And so Burns, who'd had a moderate policy during the last years of the Ford administration, and he turned on the juice.
So, did your impression? impression that he was trying to be reappointed. That comes from discussions with third parties or observation of what was actually happening? Or
came from a discussion with his son. Did you know Joe Burns?
Well, I've never met him. He's at the FCC, I think, in Washington.
He works for the Justice Department. Joe's a funny fellow. He got a PhD from Chicago, taught at UCLA for a little bit, then he was at Rice for a little bit, and then he came to Washington, and he wrote one piece for AEI on something about futures, and then he basically has gone out of business. I mean, intellectual business. Not a bad guy, but I...
People tell funny stories that when you... They kind of elliptic sentences. They say, "Well, I saw what Arthur Burns did to his son," and then they kind of cut off.
Is that right? I don't know anything about what happened between them personally, but his son is kind of an enervated guy. I mean, he's a nice fellow, but I don't think he has a. He doesn't have healthy aggression.
Yeah.
You know. And so, he's settled into the ooze and the bureaucracy at the Justice Department. I don't think there's a good damn thing there.
You think it'd be interesting for me to talk to him about his father?
Yeah.
I could just call the Justice Department.
I'll give you his number right here. His number is area code.
That's a work phone?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was a student of mine in Chicago. And I see him from time to time. In fact, he called me last week to have lunch with me and some other guy that he worked with that I got to know.
So what section is he in?
Antitrust.
Hmm.
I think he works on he's supposed to work on bank cases or financial market things.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, he didn't say anything, but the other guy, a man I know whose name is Farrell Block, he quit. He said, "It's terrible. There's nothing to do." He said, "It just corrupts you. You fall apart."
Yeah.
So he left and he started a consulting business.
So did you have contact with Burns in the mid-50s when you were at the National Bureau?
Not really. When I came there...
He was already at...
He was the head of the council.
Yeah.
And then he quit the council at one point, and then he came back there, and everybody was sort of in awe of him. And he was teaching at Columbia, and he was there, and he was a man of enormous energy. He worked late. He'd come in late in the afternoon. He'd work late. And I had some contact, and they would have... have some seminars or discussions or whatever, but he didn't have that much contact with the staff. So there was a guy who was a close friend of mine at the National Bureau who was a graduate student in Chicago. He became Burns's research assistant. And unfortunately, he was killed in a plane crash. A guy by the name of Ed Kilberg, a wonderful fellow. And so I learned a lot about Arthur Burns from Ed. And then I've talked to Milton about Burns.
Well, I'm going to do that, but
I have talked to him.
I wrote him a letter and said, "I'd like to interview you about Burns," and I got a letter back saying, essentially, "This is a very touchy subject with me. We broke. I still feel very sensitive about it. I'll talk to you about Burns before he went to Washington, or before he went to the Fed." But
in fact, I saw a letter that he wrote, that Milton wrote to somebody else I knew, going on and on about Burns. And I don't know if I can ever find the letter. And it's consistent with what he told me, which was that Milton once told me that Burns was the biggest disappointment of his life.
Yeah, that's the feeling I got from the letter. Like, it was still just too painful to talk
about. And that they were very close. The fam were very close. And then they had summer houses up in New Hampshire, Vermont. They were close together, so their children were close. Mm-hmm. Their families were close. And Burns was his teacher, and he was his sponsor.
Yeah.
And he learned a lot from Burns, and Burns was a father figure of a sort. And I remember at the time that, Burns was preparing a set of lectures that was given at Fordham.
Yeah.
Ed was, Ed Kilberg was working for him, and he was upset at some of the things that were happening in the material. And then Milton came by for a visit, and the three of us were talking, and he told him he was upset. So Milton calmed him down. He said, "Well, he goes at things in a different way than we do." He said, "But he arrives at the same point. Eventually, he'll arrive at the same point." And he didn't.
Yeah.
He didn't. So for many years, Milton was making excuses for Arthur. See? Mm-hmm. And then when he became chairman and he did a whole bunch of things that you know about, mm-hmm. then Milton was really crushed. And he felt terrible about it. And he felt he was very let down.
Yeah.
And even if he hadn't written what he did when Burns came in, mm-hmm. he still would have felt let down. That here he had this enormous responsibility and opportunity, and he fucked up.
Yeah.
Every which way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And imposed enormous damage. It's interesting. I was on the transition team for the first Nixon administration, and I was chairman of a group that put together really what turned out to be the economic plan of the Nixon administration that they followed up until the wage and price controls.
Yeah, it was a great plan.
Yep, and it. Burns was the chairman of the whole transition team. And what's his name? Who became chairman of the council?
McCracken.
Yeah, he came to our meetings and he loved our plan. He loved the plan, and so they implemented most of it. They implemented most of it. But I got to tell you one story, which was that. We were having a meeting of all the this is the task force, they call it task force. And I was the chairman of the task force on inflation, that was it. And we had a meeting in New York at the Hotel Pierre. And so they had a group of task forces working on different economics things. We all met together. And Alan Greenspan came to talk. And he was working for Burns in this transition thing. And he got up to, he said that they convened a new task force on trade policy, which we did, there was no task force. Because Nixon had made a commitment in the heat of the campaign to Strom Thurmond and to Southerners about having quotas on textiles. Because he needed the Southern vote.
Yeah, I laugh at that because William Safire has written up what happened at Camp David, and according to him, while Burns wanted to talk about the gold window, all Nixon wanted to talk about was how mad he was at Japan for not going along with voluntary restraints on textiles.
Yeah, right. Well, this fits in. So Greenspan was there as the fixer, in the sense that he got his marching orders to go implement this thing. And he acknowledged that quotas and whatever were not a good idea. He said, but we're basically stuck with them because the political decision had been made. And then there was a fellow who was on the task force with me, a guy by the name of Jim Ford, who had been a postdoctoral fellow in Chicago. That's how I knew him. And he was working with the Ford Motor Company. He was not a member of that Ford family, but... a very nice fellow. He got so mad, he got red in the face. He said, "If I knew that that Nixon was going to do this sort of thing, I wouldn't have voted for him." But anyway,
like the scandal later on.
well,
the scandal quitting Ford. It was
he quit Ford, you know.
Yeah.
Then, but Greenspan didn't quit, and he didn't do what some of us. Some of us did. You know, he just went along.
Sure.
And so, and I remember after that, Norman Torrey and I met with him at the plaza to have a drink and talk about things, and it didn't bother him. We talked about that, and it did bother him.
Yeah.
So, that was the time that Greenspan sort of hooked up with Burns. See. And that...
So Burns must have been instrumental in Greenspan being appointed head of the council when Ford came in.
I suppose.
Yeah.
Although I really don't know.
Yeah.
See, because that was a little strange appointment, because Greenspan at that time didn't have a PhD. And he had no academic credentials. And the chairman had always, for some years, had been that, you know.
Well, Burns was running economic policy, so you basically didn't need a council.
But Greenspan developed, when he was on the chairman of the council, he developed a very close, friendly relationship with the president, and he used to go off with him to play golf and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he ignored everybody else around there. And there was, anyway, that's another story.
Greenspan and the council.
Yeah, he ignored the other members of the council. He ignored the staff. It was just between him and the president. They were just, and so in fact he was away a lot of the time.
But my impression of that period is that Burns was
running everything.
Yeah, so it didn't make a lot of difference what the council was doing.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think, and besides, Burns had it was the same. So I think that Burns was probably. I don't have any direct evidence, but consistent with what happened before, that Greenspan was in there still reporting to Burns. This is all rambling, but I don't know if this has been helpful to you.
Oh, absolutely.
It's the stuff about Patman.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah, that's
important. And I talked
important.
To...
Yeah.
I talked to Bob a lot about that, and he repeated several stories to me. Over and over, and that in an unusual moment, Patman did disclose his strategy to Bob, which was that the whole thing with the Fed was. Seriously, it was just a charade.
Well, he certainly could terrorize lower-level people with his forays and...
the inquiries and the... The inquiries, he used to use the GAO and whatever, but it never came to anything.
But did he get anything done that he wanted to get done other than just get reelected from a populist...
No, he got reelected, but what he wanted done was... to get legislation that was favorable, that would help his clients and his constituents, which were the SNLs and the credit unions and the builders.
Mm-hmm. And he got that in Reg Q.
He got that every which way.
Mm-hmm.
And that the stuff on the banks, and the big banks, and the moneyed interest, and the Wall Street, and the and whatever, and the mm-hmm. Fed, and he used to repeat the most outrageous things, and we'd straighten them out. All they like how a single bank gets $1, and through the fractional reserve system, mm-hmm. a single bank loans out the same dollar 10 times.
Yeah, the feeling that seniors gives banks something for nothing.
Yeah, and every banker then has a license to print money because they get it $1 and then they multiply it.
Mm-hmm.
So we explained to him the difference between a single bank and a banking system, and a bank can only loan out what it has, etc. And he would go through it and he would acknowledge it.
Yeah.
And he just repeats the same thing. Now, he was not crazy. He would sometimes give people the impression that he was a little wacko,
mm-hmm.
or that he was a little addled, but he wasn't at all.
Hmm.
And
he kept getting reelected, so he was
kept getting reelected. He'd been reelected, I think, every year since 1930.
Mm-hmm.
He started out as a firebrand, and but he was a fixture in that town, Texarkana, not very close to Hope, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
He was on the other side of the other side of the railroad tracks, literally, but not metaphorically, because in Texarkana, the railroad goes down the main street. On one side of the street is Arkansas, and the other side is Texas.
Yeah, I've been through there.
So
yeah. Don't ask me why.
They're a long time ago, yeah. But the so he came from the Texas side, and Hope, Arkansas is a few miles there on the Arkansas side.
Yeah. Well, this has been very interesting. I'd really appreciate you sharing with me.
Okay. If there's really any...